Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we'll start today in Washington, where our own Massachusetts Congresswoman Catherine Clark has made history. Her House Democratic colleagues elected her assistant speaker, the fourth-ranking position in the House, becoming the second-highest-ranking Democratic woman in the history of the House after Speaker Pelosi and the most powerful Congresswoman ever from Massachusetts. She joins us on the line now. Congresswoman Clark, welcome back.
Oh, thank you so much. It's so good to be with you.
So I want to congratulate you. I hope you did something, a little something at least, to celebrate yesterday. How did you celebrate after you got elected to this important position?
Well, I have to say, the celebration is going to be put off until I'm home at Thanksgiving. It continues to be a really busy schedule here, and we will take a moment to really let it sink in. But we're in such a time here in Washington and across the country, and the urgency of the work that we need to do weighs heavily on all of us.
What's going to be most different about how you celebrate Thanksgiving this year? That may seem on its face like sort of a trivial question, but people are facing unprecedented moments in their holidays. What will be different for you? What are you going to do differently? And what might you miss that you would normally do?
Well, usually I host about 25 extended family members, and this year we'll be down to 4. So that's the big difference. But we are very thankful that we are going to be able to have good health and food on our table. And sadly, that's not going to be true for many, many people in Massachusetts. And so with this position from yesterday, what it really means to me is not only to have a seat at the table, because I believe when women are at the leadership table, different perspectives are raised, but to be able to be that advocate for families at home who are suffering. They're suffering in loss of life and livelihood. They are struggling to feed their families, and we are looking at the expiration of many programs that were put in place to help people through this pandemic at the end of December. So I will always thankful for my family, and even in a small gathering that we will reach out across the country on a Zoom call. But my heart and thoughts are really with those who continue to struggle through this pandemic and the economic fallout.
You talked about, when women have a seat at the table, right? Different things are possible. I really want to talk about that for a minute. I've known a number of women who have broken through barriers or pioneered in leadership. In my own experience, being the first woman to run Catholic Charities here in the Archdiocese, I had the same experience, which is you break ground for women and you are acutely aware that other women are watching and that the choices that you're making are going to affect how others perceive women in leadership, what the issues are, what's possible. I wonder, is that in your mind? Are you experiencing this ascension to assistant speaker as a woman who has become assistant speaker, or are you assistant speaker and you happen to be a woman? Do you understand my question?
I very much see it as a woman who's become assistant speaker. I think that women in this country voted in record numbers. I have spent a good deal of my efforts here in Congress promoting the issues and working on the issues that women face, whether it's caring for our kids and also older parents at the same time. Reproductive health is not a bargaining chip for women. It's an economic issue as well as a deeply personal one. Gender pay inequality, paid family leave, expanding and rescuing our childcare industry at this time. these are issues that women are faced with. And what we have now is this incredible political activism by women because they know what's at stake. And we are seeing the fallout from this pandemic affect women economically in a particularly harsh and disproportionate way. So many women work in the service industry, primarily Black and brown women, and those jobs have disappeared. And with it also has disappeared for many parents the school day. And so with a lack of childcare, a lack of income, the stress on women, the job loss, my fear that they will be set back economically, not just for a year or till the end of the pandemic, but potentially for a decade, are very real. So,
I feel that weight as
I take this position on.
I wanted to ask you more about that. I apologize for interrupting. I thought you were done with that sentence, and I did want to hear what you had to say. You've talked a lot about childcare, and you just brought up this moment that is so interesting. So here we are. We're talking to you. The U.S. Congress has been having a moment for women for a couple of years now. You've ascended to a higher level of leadership. Women are occupying the legislative space in a different way. And at the same time, as you said, we have women dropping out of the workforce. The New York Times reported 1.1 million total people dropping out of the workforce in August and September, 800,000 of them women over the age
of
20. So it seems like some of our systems are bringing women forward and some of our systems are tripping women back. How do you use the progress in the first one to mitigate the losses we're seeing in other places?
Yeah, and it's, you know, it is the tragedy for women of this pandemic, not only the loss of loved ones and concern for health, but the economic issues that are impacting them. Just like you said, 800,000 jobs lost, women leaving the workforce, and much of this has to do with childcare. When you don't even have schools that are able to open safely, all of this brings to bear on women this choice between who can care for their children and allow them to go to work. And for low-income women, women who are in low-wage jobs, women who are, don't make the same pay as their male peers. We know that, even if you are in a dual income house, the woman tends to let the job go because it is one that was bringing in less income when children need to be cared for. So we have to address this crisis of childcare because it's the only way that we are going to be able to have women return to the workforce, be able to take a job and have time to find one. But also it is about making sure that our entire economy can recover, which it will not if we don't shore up the childcare industry when it has been so devastated. And it also highlights the, almost 98% of all childcare providers are women, and many of those are also women of color, and yet they are paid very low wages for the work they do that is so critical to the education of our children and the support of a workforce. And so we have to look at childcare as sort of this this picture that it paints for us of women in the economy. And we have to be serious about remedying it if we truly want equality for women and an economy that is inclusive of everyone.
In the last minute that we have with you, as we were watching this week to see if you would be elected to this position, I was thinking of photographs I've seen of you and the other women of the delegation from Massachusetts wearing white after the 2018 elections. Did you think then that you could get here now? And what did you have in your sights if you got this role?
You know, I never thought about a specific role, but why I came to Congress is to work on these issues for women and children. And I often think of the words that Nikki Song has said to me when I called her. She was the only woman in the mass delegation when I was running. And she said the small things that you can do in a line item in a bill can impact millions of people. And so I have not only tried to keep that in mind and keep working for these families in the Commonwealth, in my district, and across the country to make sure that women and children have what they need, but also opening the door and helping bring in women and women of color to Congress so that we can truly reflect American women and their needs and their power at this time in our history.
That is Congresswoman Catherine Clark, who represents Massachusetts' 5th District. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Have you had one of those moments since this pandemic started when you just suddenly felt sad or you suddenly felt the weight of it all? I remember covering one of Governor Baker's press conferences in the spring, and it was the first time he referred to masks as something that we're going to become the new normal. And I remember in that moment, I was just hit by how much of our daily way of life we were in the process of losing. And that was way of life. You may have experienced massive loss, like someone you love. This week, the U.S. death toll from the virus passed 250,000 people. In Massachusetts, we've lost more than 10,000 of our friends, our neighbors, our family. Sometimes we know we're grieving and sometimes we don't. Claire Willis says grief varies widely by person, as does how we handle it, how long we're in its grasp. She's a clinical social worker and the co-founder of the Boston nonprofit Facing Cancer Together. Claire also regularly leads bereavement and support groups. She's got a new book with co-author Maureen Crawford Samuelson. It's called Opening to Grief, Finding Your Way from Loss to Peace. Claire, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
And listener, Claire has said she'll take your calls. If you have questions on coping with grief or a story you need to share with her, 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Claire, I'm thinking about this 250,000 number. We were talking about it as a team this morning. How do you even get your head around that? How do you grieve? I mean, more than the deaths in Vietnam, World War I, how do we collectively get our heads around that size of loss and process it?
I'm not sure that we actually do. I think we access it depending on how the face of it comes into our life, because each of us is impacted very differently by it. But the enormity of it is pretty hard to take in all at once. I think, you know, sometimes in a conversation I'm having with someone, I'll say, well, the traffic at Thanksgiving, and then I realize there's probably not going to be traffic at Thanksgiving. Or I hope to see you, and then I forget for a moment. It's very hard to take in the enormity. This thing has tendrils that just go forever in our lives and touch so many parts.
Yeah, I talked at the top about that moment that I still remember so vividly from one of the press conferences with Governor Baker. And again, I think for me that was a moment of small loss, but grief. People have had small losses. They've had big losses. You write about the fact that people have lost sort of a sense of security, daily routine. And I know we're familiar in our culture with processing the big losses, but how do we have a mechanism for recognizing and dealing with and honoring what we're feeling about the smaller ones?
Well, you know, it's really interesting that you ask me that, because grief, I think often people think of grief as sadness and sorrow, but grief really has as many faces as there are people who are grieving. So it often shows up as impatience, irritability. Anxiety is another big expression of grief. Anger and rage, which we can often see in politically, certainly we can see that. Gratitude and sometimes even relief are all expressions of grief. So it has, people don't always recognize that they're grieving because they think of it in smaller terms of just sadness and sorrow. But it really has as many expressions as there are people who are grieving.
I'd like to go to a call, if you don't mind. 1-800-423-8255. We have Lauren on the line from Somerville. Lauren, how are you?
Good. Thank you so much. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. Please go ahead.
I'm also studying, you're not studying, I'm studying mental health therapy, and I'm right at the end. And my question is about grieving loss of connection with family members who have very different ideology around politics and COVID. And it's separated us a lot, and it's keeping us apart this holiday season as well.
I'm sorry about that, Lauren. Let's see what Claire has to say.
Oh, that is such a common issue. I can't tell you how many times I've heard this question. One of the things you can do is agree not to talk about politics. I think part of what happens sometimes is that, as I was saying before, that grief has a lot of different presentations, and sometimes people choose the more angry route rather than feel the vulnerability of grief and the sorrow of loss. Trying to find a bridge of commonality, one of the things that I often do when I'm in a polarized conversation is I'll say, I'm curious about that. Can you tell me more? Because it cuts down on the reactivity, and it helps you as the questioner begin to understand the thinking of the other person. It gets into more of a gray, nuanced zone. Do you know what I'm saying?
I'm not sure we still have the caller, but I will say on her behalf, what you're saying does make sense, Claire. And we'll bring another caller in just a minute. I'm going to take a second, though, because I'm going to ask you to read a section of the book. And it's from the introduction. It lays out the spectrum of grief that we might be talking about. You wrote the book in May this year. This is from then. Why don't you go ahead?
We feel the loss of family members, friends and neighbors we loved, celebrities and public figures we followed. We're missing the person we were and the way we lived not long ago. In the midst of this invisible, highly contagious virus, we grieve the loss of a kind of innocence. As we don our masks and gloves, we fear being infected or infecting others and wonder what impact these changes will have on our worldview and our emotional well-being. I'd like to just add here that David Brooks, in a column in the New York Times last April, just at the very beginning of this pandemic, wrote his readers and asking how they were faring. And he got 5,000 replies within a few days. And one of the things he wrote in the column, and I love what he wrote, he said, there's a river of woe, a river of grief running through the culture. And I think that pretty much describes the way its tendrils have reached all of us.
Claire, I'm going to go back to the phones because we have people who'd like to talk to you. 1-800-423-8255. We have another Claire, actually, from Essex. Claire from Essex, you are on with Claire Willis.
Thank you. I just wanted to know if you had any advice for how I can help my father come to terms. He's 90 years old. He's a cancer patient, and he's a widower. And he spends every holiday with me and my husband and four kids, and I can't pick him up this Thanksgiving to come spend it with us. And he's sad and he's lonely, and I wondered if you had any tips of how I could help him through this.
Is he able to use Zoom at all?
He's very good with technology. We do FaceTime him quite a bit.
You know, I think one of the things that I've seen in my bereavement groups is that when people have something in handwriting from someone they love, it helps keep the connection going, because so much of our correspondence today is text and email and electronic. And I wonder about writing him a note so that on Thanksgiving he has something from you and from other members of the family. And certainly, as always, a phone call or a Zoom connection so he can see you is important if he's savvy in that way.
Thank you for that, Claire. And Claire from Essex will be thinking about you and your family. I gotta believe that's hard, and I'm sorry about it. So Claire Willis, before we go to another call, one of the things that really struck me in reading your book was this idea that anger is grief, that, well, not all anger is grief, but that anger can be a manifestation of grief, and that what we've come to know as these stages of grief aren't really stages. They're things that can rack and stack and overlap each other. Can you talk a little more about that?
Yeah, I think anger is a very common expression of grief because it gives people a sense of agency, and if we're feeling sad or sorrow in that expression of grief, there's a sense of vulnerability and helplessness that we often feel. And I think that can be very uncomfortable for many people to feel that kind of helplessness. So anger is a way that it often expresses itself. I want to just say one thing about the stages of grief, because the understanding in our culture that these are stages that Elizabeth Kubler-Ross wrote for people who were grieving isn't actually accurate. They were written for people who were dying, and they got applied to people who were grieving. And one of the things that's happened is people have compared themselves to those stages and end up feeling like they're falling short of how their grief is supposed to look. So grief is never a linear progression. It doesn't go from A to Z. It's much more like a ball of yarn that's knotted up, and we have to untangle it. So it's important to not try and use or overlay a model of grief on your grief, because everybody's grief looks different.
I'd like to go back to the phones, 1-800-423-8255, to talk about grief with Claire Willis. We have Mary on the phone from Andover. Mary, go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My five siblings and I were dealing with grief before the pandemic started, given that we lost both our parents in an 11-month span of time. And unfortunately, I had to quarantine when my mom's anniversary came by, and I just felt so alone and so sad, depressed. And I reached out to my friends. I posted something on social media, and they rallied, and they dropped things off at my house. They sent me messages. So I guess what I want to say is that you don't have to be alone in this. Reach out to your friends. Reach out to your family who can interact with you, because it's good for you, but it's also good for them. Having that opportunity to do something for others in this situation really boosts people up. So I just wanted to share that with everyone. Hopefully it helps.
Thank you so much, because I think one of the things that we've learned is that when we reach out and we're generous with another, it helps our grief as well as their grief. So in doing little random acts of kindness, it's one way to work with our grief that's really helpful. So thank you. That's a wonderful idea.
Claire, several thoughts crashed into my head at once there. One of the things that your book, Opening to Grief, does is offer people some techniques and some things they can do to begin to, as you say, open themselves to their grief, go ahead and experience it so that it can sort of run its way through. We are entering a time when we know a lot of people grieve anyway around the holidays, just as we heard from Mary. What's one thing you might tell listeners, a practice or a habit that might help them address their grief or sit with their grief as they're having it?
I think the first chapter in the book is called Starting with Kindness. And I think being kind to ourselves and not allowing any internal voices that tell us how this is supposed to look dictate how we feel about our grief, and to treat it as we would a tender friend or a child that was hurting, to stay gentle and kind with however it is we're feeling, and not overlay any of the models of grief or anything that we read about what it should look like on ourselves. That's I think that's the most important thing to start with, just to counter some of the prevailing myths. Most of us have ideas about grief and what it should look like, and we might be under the oppression of some of those concepts. The second thing I would say, and it may sound a little bit counterintuitive, but one of the ways we can build resilience in the face of grief is to try to notice three or four things each day that are right for which we can be grateful, because our minds are hardwired to notice what's wrong. And if we can hold what's right next to and in equal proportion to what's wrong, it can be very helpful in creating some inner strength and building our resilience to hold our suffering. So one of the things that I often suggest people do is to keep a gratitude journal at the end of the day, because when you commit to that, the next day you start to look for things that are right. And we're not talking about doing this at the expense of what's wrong, but holding what's right alongside.
I think we have time for one more call. Alex is on the line from Belmont. Alex, go ahead.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I have a question as a parent. I have five children, and there's obviously a lot of loss for them, particularly I have a senior in high school and a sophomore in high school. So they're, I just am wondering if you have any suggestions for how to help them with what they're missing out on.
Claire.
Oh, boy. You know, I have to say, honestly, I don't have a lot of experience working with kids. I don't know how to answer that question, and I wish I could do better. I don't know what to say to that.
Well, Alex, let me just say to you, I have one that graduated senior year at the start of the pandemic and a sophomore now. And with both of them, one of the things that I'm groping my way through is just making sure that they can express themselves when they are feeling grief.
Yes.
Because they get embarrassed about it. And I can be someone that they can tell how they're feeling. And Claire, you talk about that communication in your book.
Yeah, you know, actually, now that you say that, I'm just thinking, too, I think journaling these times can be very important. I think having a record of these times for these kids will be important, and writing their feelings out. There's a lot of research that that is emerging about the benefits of journal writing, and that's one thing I would encourage them to do as a form of expression if they're not as verbal or not wanting to talk about their feelings. That's certainly something that would be helpful.
And when you help people get started on journaling, Claire, how do you know, maybe I'm projecting, but there are many things I intend to start doing but then don't. How do you help people get over the hump, whether it's a young person or somebody in one of your bereavement groups? How do you help them get over that hurdle and actually start the practice?
You know, I try and do it with very simple exercises. So one of the things that I frequently do with people in my bereavement groups is I'll ask them, they'll say, there are so many things I don't want to ever forget. So I'll say, just write a sentence, I remember, and see where it goes. And then write another phrase, I remember, and just keep writing that stem. And when we set aside the time to remember, we often remember things we didn't know we would ever remember. And so that becomes a discipline and a practice in itself. Another thing to do, I often hear people talking about, is that they write letters to their loved ones who have died. At the end of the day, they might write a letter saying, what I wanted you to know today. And that's a way that they can feel connected to the person that they've loved. And that's, a lot of people in my bereavement groups have done that.
Claire Willis, you've been so helpful today. I'd love to have you back again another time. That's Claire Willis, a clinical social worker, who her book, co-written with Maureen Crawford Samuelson, is Opening to Grief, Finding Your Way from Loss to Peace. Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to continue to take your calls for the rest of the hour now, but we're going to shift gears and we're going to talk about vaccines, coronavirus vaccines, and we're going to take your vaccine questions with a panel of experts. You know, when Pfizer and then Moderna announced these efficacy rates of their vaccines during trials, 90%, then 94.5% for Moderna, then Pfizer comes back and says, now we're at 95%. It felt like the conversation around coronavirus shifted and we started to see this note of hope. But we also know it raises a lot of other questions about vaccine safety, how quickly it'll be available, how many doses there will be, and whether people will take it. So we want to ask you, will you take the vaccine? Are you nervous about using it, or are you anxiously awaiting it? And what else do you need to know to be ready to take a vaccine when it comes out? We'll take your calls at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We have two guests to help have this conversation. We have Dr. Helen Boucher, the chief of the Division of Geographic Medicine and Infectious Diseases at Tufts Medical Center. Dr. Boucher is also a professor at the Tufts University School of Medicine and has done a number, actually, of our Ask the Doctor segments over the months. And we have Dr. Christopher Gill, professor of global health at the Boston University School of Public Health. And Dr. Gill has done extensive work on vaccine trials. Welcome back to Radio Boston to both of you.
Great.
Thanks
to be
so
here.
Much.
And Helen, so, so good to be together with you.
You too, Chris.
I was one of your fellows many years ago.
Yeah, great to be with you.
It's great to have the two of you together. And sometimes we ask these kinds of made-up scales to give a sense of where you think we are. So here's your scale. On the one end is quiet golf clap, and on the other is full-blown rendition of the Hallelujah Chorus. When you look at where we are in the vaccine, in the sort of the coronavirus vaccine news right now, are we at Hallelujah Chorus or Quiet Golf Clap? Where are you? Dr. Boucher, maybe you can start.
Well, Tiziana, I would say that I'm leaning towards the positive, but with caution. The data that we have is from press releases only. And so this is a very unique situation in the setting of a pandemic that we're seeing the data exactly as it happens. But this is, we've seen really a snapshot, and we need to wait for the very important process of review and the regulatory process and the public vetting of these data to happen so that we can be convinced of the safety and effectiveness of any vaccine that is authorized.
So that is reasonably measured, although I wanted more, a little less golf clap, I have to admit. But Dr. Gill, how about you? Are you in that cautiously optimistic phase as well?
Yeah, I mean, Helen's point is absolutely correct that there's so much we don't know. And yet, at the same time, I find that what we're living through right now is such a remarkable first, you know, ever vaccine licensed in under a year, really effectively 6 months that this will have taken place in. And there's no precedent for that. So I'm more sort of like just in awe.
How long should it take, Dr. Gill? Well, so when you say unprecedented, how unprecedented is that?
Typically, a new vaccine would take, you know, 7 to 10 years from phase 1 trials through licensure. So this is like nothing we've ever seen before.
So, Dr. Boucher, when I hear Dr. Gill say that, of course, one of the first questions that comes to my mind is, well, if it normally takes 7 years, and there's probably a reason for that, and we're doing it this fast this time, how do we feel confident that it's going to be safe?
Right. Well, that is a very important question, right? Because it's not a vaccine that's going to get us out of this mess. It's vaccination. It's people taking the vaccine. And so the way we can be confident is that this process that's starting now, the review of the data, the vetting by the FDA and their advisory committee, and then the CDC and their advisory committee, that all that happens with no shortcuts. And we have a promise from the companies, from the FDA, and from the CDC that that will be the process. And many of us have said that if that process completes and there is an authorization, that we'll be the first ones to line up to take that vaccine.
Dr. Gill, it also makes me think there are these steps and people have to sign off. The pressure to sign off must be tremendous. Does that raise any worries? And just quickly, let me put out the number for callers too. They're starting to come in, but I want people to know 800-423-8255. Dr. Gill.
Yeah, well, I mean, people are dying every day. And so I think you're right. It's not just an unprecedented event, you know, in the sense that this is the fastest that a vaccine has been developed and brought to market in history. But we are under unprecedented pressure to do so. The two are, of course, linked. And, you know, we are looking at hundreds or close to thousands of people dying every day. So absolutely there is pressure to do this, which doesn't mean that all safeguards should not be observed, as Helen is saying. But the stakes are incredibly high right now. You know, literally every day that we wait, you know, potentially another 1,000 people will die. And so I think that there's an urgency here that we have also never really experienced before. And I would say, you know, we've been through the H1N1 crisis, and that doesn't even come close to what we're talking about right now.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to ask your questions of Drs. Gill and Boucher about the coronavirus vaccine as it's developing. We've got TJ on the line from Providence. TJ, go ahead.
Yeah, so my question is, well, first I'll state that I'm confident in our government's ability to approve a vaccine and not approve one until it's ready. And I'm willing to take it if the health experts say so. However, what I'm really concerned about and what really makes me anxious is we don't know how many vaccines will be available from each of these companies at the beginning. And they're really, the plan seems to be very vague in how many are going to be available, when they're going to be available after it's approved, and how long that's going to take as far as manufacturing.
So you mean doses, TJ, just to make sure I'm understanding.
Correct.
You, right? How many
yes.
doses? Great. So, Dr. Boucher, what do we and don't we know about the speed to which these doses can become available?
Yeah, well, this is really important, right? And the whole point of Operation Warp Speed was to gear up the manufacturing ahead of even knowing if a vaccine worked. And so we're very grateful for that, and our taxpayer dollars contributed to that. What we know from reports that we have is that by the end of this year, by the end of 2020, there's an estimate of 50 million doses of the Pfizer vaccine and 20 million doses of the Moderna NIH vaccine that will be available. So remember, it's a two-dose vaccine, so you'd cut those numbers in half. So that means we could vaccinate perhaps 35 million people with the two doses before the end of December if, and that's a big if, the vaccine were available. In 2021, there's in the billions of doses predicted for both vaccines. So the manufacturing is gearing up.
This two-stage distribution, that's probably an overly fancy way to say it. You got to get a shot, a dose, and then a month later you have to get another one. How, Dr. Gill, how much is that a hindrance to successfully vaccinating people? I mean, it doubles the behavior you have to participate in order to be vaccinated.
Mm-hmm. So you're correct that anything that, you know, has to be replicated at the scale of millions or hundreds of millions of separate events is going to have a significant effect on the overall speed with which you can roll out this new product. So, it's actually not a trivial issue, in fact. And I think it's sort of one of the many questions we have here as we sort of try to decide, you know, how do we prioritize the distribution of the vaccine? The government has made its intent clear through the CDC that we're going to start with hospital workers first, which seems prudent given that they're most exposed, and then sort of move down through different categories of risk and priority. But all of this is sort of predicated on the assumption that the rollout proceeds smoothly, and it's not just the production of the vaccines, of course, it's the distribution of the vaccines and the supply chain logistics that go into that, which appear to be immensely complicated, especially for the Pfizer vaccine because of its requirements for an extreme degree of cold chain.
Let's go back to the phones, 800-423-8255. We'll take a couple calls here. We've got Devin from Marblehead. Devin, go ahead.
Hi, thank you. I have two questions. Are the vaccines being considered, do they lessen the severity of symptoms like the flu vaccine, or do they give you immunity for all time like the polio vaccine?
All right, Devin, thanks for that question. And I think Patrick from Andover has a similar question, so let me get Patrick in here too. Hi, Patrick, go ahead.
Yeah, so my question is, we've been told for several days now that these vaccines are between 90 and 95% effective. And I'm curious as to what that effectiveness is. Is it immune for a week or 2 weeks or a month? There was a recent article in NEJM that gave immunity for basically a little over a month, but the study was stopped and we don't have any follow-up. So are we being, how effective is it and for what period of time?
Thanks for that, Patrick. So Devin and Patrick both asking about the length of immunity. Also, is it immunity? Is it symptom repression? I think that's you, Dr. Boucher, who sounded like you were ready to answer.
So I'm happy to give it a stab. Dr. Gill may want to correct me since he's been involved in the trials. But the end point is getting COVID disease, so confirmed COVID infection. So basically they start after a couple of weeks after the second dose and look for people who develop COVID. And what they found in both studies is that significantly fewer people who got the vaccine develop COVID disease. And in the Pfizer vaccine, they also showed that there was significantly less severe disease as they did with the Moderna. So both of them prevent COVID and severe COVID, which are endpoints that we care a lot about. To your other questions about immunity and how long it lasts, these are all very important questions. Remember, we've seen press releases only. We haven't seen all that kind of data yet, but that will be the kind of data that's being assessed. And in fact, these patients are going to be followed for 2 years total. So we'll be learning about this for some time to come.
Anything else you'd add, Dr. Gill, to Devin and Patrick's questions?
Yeah, no, I think Helen has summarized this beautifully. The question about persistence of immunity is something that by definition we cannot know until a certain degree of time has passed. You know, right now we're looking at the immune responses in the short term, you know, on a scale of several months at most. And, you know, the question of how, you know, will it protect for several years? will take several years to answer. We can't know that at this point.
I forgive me if this is an ignorant question, but do we need it to protect for several years? I mean, in terms of developing herd immunity through vaccination, or is it possible that, like with the flu, there are different strains at different times, so you couldn't have one that protects for several years? I really just honestly don't know if that's a ball we should have our eye on or not.
Well, some of this is speculation, of course, but one of the big differences between the coronavirus and the influenza virus is the influenza virus has this sort of fantastic ability to adapt and mutate. And that's why we have to take a fresh flu shot every single year, because the target is constantly changing. By comparison, the coronavirus is sort of an evolutionary slug. It really does not mutate very much. It's a very stable target. And so it seems unlikely that one would have to revaccinate, with a different version of the vaccine on a regular basis like we do with the flu. So really the question is, when you get a two-dose series of the vaccine, for example, will that induce immunologic memory? Which is a very distinct concept, though related to whether the concentrations of antibodies generated by the antibody, by the vaccine, will stay high for an extended period of time. Because typically vaccines will induce a rise in antibodies, but then over time the antibody concentrations will fall. But the falling of the antibodies does not mean that the immune memory has not been established. Because typically when someone is later exposed to that, that pathogen again, the antibody concentrations will rise promptly. That's the way our immune system is in fact designed. It's very energy intense for lymphocytes to constantly pumping out antibodies. What you're supposed to do is to have them sort of go quiescent for some period of time and then be able to boost on demand later. And there was interesting and exciting data that just came out just a few days ago in the New England Journal showing that the one of the sort of the measures we have of immunologic memory through T cells is clearly demonstrable in people who have had coronavirus infection, which probably will translate to vaccine efficacy as well and the persistence of long-term immunity. So my guess is that they will last for a long time, but of course, time will tell. We can speculate all we want, but we'll know more in 2 years is how these actually perform.
Okay, let's go to David in Westminster, West Vermont.
Yes, hi, thank you. Great program here. Question I have is really based on history, and seldom is a vaccine the vaccine. If we look at polio and the world went crazy over Jonas Salk, but then it uses Sabin that was developed 6 years later. My question is whether you believe Project Warp Speed is really a sustainable program that would allow for and facilitate, continuous development upgrades to whatever vaccine comes first?
It's a great question. Dr. Boucher, what about that? Warp Speed is a sustainable project for this is how we do it now.
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I am certainly not the world's expert on this, but what I would say is that I think Operation Warp Speed has certainly served is serving its purpose of jumpstarting this whole process and getting us to having multiple vaccines in the clinic. And to your point, we don't know which one will be the best, but we want one that works as soon as possible to help get us out of this, almost 200,000 deaths a day we're seeing now in our country, right? Or 2,000 deaths. So it's working. I think the question will be if it can transition to a market-driven process over time, which has kind of been the history, right? Because we're going to have to vaccinate for this disease forever. So it may well be that the market will be able to drive vaccines starting in a couple of years, for example, and so that Operation Warp Speed could be directed to the next pandemic. And that's a very important message, right? This has taught us that pandemic preparedness is very, very important. And our government, I think, is already thinking about that and preparing for the next pandemic.
I think we can get one more call in. We've got Amjad on the line from Lincoln. Go ahead.
Hi. My question is, during the study, the people who took the vaccine, they were masked and maintaining proper distance. So how does it actually show on your percent effectiveness if they were already being protected?
It's a great question, and one actually I was also hoping to ask Dr. Gill, so I'll turn to you on that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think we just have to look around us to sort of answer that question. Mask compliance is far from perfect. And even when masks are worn perfectly, they're not perfectly effective. And so you're quite correct that it reduces the rate of exposure. And so would make it, you know, less, you would see expect to see fewer cases of COVID-19 in a patient population that was using masks consistently. And as a sponsor, you would have to respond to that by increasing your sample size or increasing the number, the duration that you were following the population. What we have seen is that because of the accelerated transmission in COVID-19 across the nation, where the rates are really going up and up and up and up, even in places which are still using masks at a high rate, that the this was one of the factors that allowed both of these studies to achieve or come to closure much sooner than they would have otherwise, because the event rate was going up despite the use of masks and social distancing. In other words, we are not perfect in our use of masks, and that is what allows these studies to occur.
Dr. Boucher, we've seen surveys on fluctuations in the level of willingness that people may have to take the vaccine. A Pew study in September showed a 21% drop over 4 months in the percentage of people who said they were willing to take the vaccine. What percentage of the population do we need in the end to be vaccinated?
Yeah, this is very important, Tiziana. And, you know, we're guided by modeling and past history here, but the estimates, most experts are estimating around half to 60% of the population need to achieve immunity by vaccination before we would get vaccine-induced herd immunity.
And what can we do from a communications campaign, et cetera, to drive up openness and willingness to take that vaccine? Either of you are welcome to answer that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm happy to start. I think that doing what we're doing right now, and that so many of us in the infectious disease world are doing with our public health colleagues, is communicating often, honestly, transparently, allowing the process that is so important to proceed without any interference or impediment, and then just, you know, being there as a source of truth for what we know and what we don't know, and helping people make the decision about the risks and benefits of any therapy.
Well, we could keep going, but we're almost out of time. So, Dr. Gill, just last word from you, just briefly, about taking the vaccine.
I agree with what Helen said, but the one thing I would add is that, you know, it is natural to some degree for people to be anxious about any new drug or any new vaccine, particularly a vaccine which is going to be used widely. And so I think we need to be humble and aware that some degree of concern and anxiety it may be actually rational, and we should approach the problem in that line of thought.
And that's Dr. Christopher Gill, Professor of Global Health at the Boston University School of Public Health, and Dr. Helen Boucher, Chief of the Division of Geographic Medicine and Infectious Diseases at Tufts Medical Center. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thanks, Tiziana.
Thank you, Tiziana.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston's a production of 90.9 WBUR. I'm Tiziana Deering. Tune in tomorrow for Radio Boston's Week in Review.